Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I have Bill Wagner. He's responsible for C# content on docs.microsoft.com. His team is also responsible for all of the .NET content. Bill's the author of Effective C# and More Effective C#. And how far back do we go, Bill?
Wow, that's probably back in the 2005 timeframe, 2004.
Yeah, something like that. I think that's right.
One of the first code mashes.
Oh, frightening. So I really want to talk to you about documentation because Microsoft's documentation has radically changed over the past few years. Would you agree with that?
I hope so. I think we've done a lot of really good work there.
Yeah, as a consumer, I would say that you have, that I'm finding that the information is more accessible and the examples are more tuned to the thing that is being exemplified rather than let me show you what a great programmer I am. And generally, I find it extremely useful. In fact, you guys are going to put the publishing industry in even deeper trouble than it is.
I think it was already there. So I think there were a few different things that we did, not even just my team, but everything around Docs that is having this kind of impact. First, if you look at MSDN, it was designed for what the web was mid-late 90s kind of timeframe. So how we built a web, or at that time, how the team there built the web of information and linked across different things and linked it to F1 Help and Visual Studio matched what the web was then. And I think coming into roughly 2015, there was a big engineering effort to totally redesign the system. So totally redesign how the site is built, how it's displayed, content reimagined in terms of how we want to link to different things and how we expect people to spend their time there. And I think overall it's, we're still evolving, but I think it is in a much, much better place.
Yes, well, I'm reacquainting myself with TypeScript and VS Code and discovering that there is a great deal of information, but sometimes I'm sort of torn between the written documentation and the videos, and there is a path through there, though, that I think you've made fairly clear.
I think we're trying, and we're still learning too. Our manager, lead for all of content, kind of talks about this in terms of different modalities people use to learn. Some people prefer the videos. Some people prefer things like MS Learn, where it's more interactive and you're doing things and building software or going through exercises and learn by doing. Some people like to learn by reading, and all of us don't live in just one of those spaces. We kind of go back and forth between all three of them, depending on what we're trying to learn, if we're trying to problem solve, if we're trying to learn, trying to get the concepts, or trying to go deeper. So we try to think of all of those together to build an ecosystem.
Tell me about MS Learn. I think that's probably the part that is it the newest part, or maybe it's the part that I know least?
I think MS Learn right now is the newest part. You're going to see continuous evolution in both Docs and, our video space and Channel 9 and so on. But MS Learn is taking the idea that, these things become more interactive. So you're going to see more interactivity in the way you learn on our properties. You can see it in Docs in some ways too. We're adding C# interactive into a lot of the API documentation. So, you look up, say, string.format, and you have examples that run in the web page, right? But going back to Learn, it's sort of targeted toward a goal. So, maybe I want to get an Azure certification, or we've got, C# 101 learning path, right? So what's the beginning stuff I need to learn if I'm just learning C# or just learning how to do web programming with ASP.NET Core? And each of those are more of a path of different modules. And each module should take you maybe, half an hour to 45 minutes or so, maybe an hour. And as you build through each of those modules that teach you one specific concept, then from there, then you continue on your learning path and keep growing until you've gained the set of skills that you came there to learn.
That sounds like a great combination of, would you call it, modalities for learning? I mean, the ability to move among those different ways and to interact with it what's the word I want? Not so passively, but actively interact with it and get feedback on how your learning is going. That is something that I will need to spend more time with.
I definitely recommend it. You know, find modules and things that you think are interesting that you want to learn and let us know how we're doing there.
Sounds good to me. I'm going to turn to your area of specialty, which is C#. I had Mads on talking about C#. We've looked at C# 9 a couple times. I think one thing that would be very helpful on this podcast would be to talk about some of the things that are new in C# in a little more depth. For example, records. I asked Mads where you would use records, and we talked about that a little bit, but if you and I could get into some use cases.
I think of it as, you know, how many times when you're writing code, do you write a type, a class, you know, or a struct, but usually a class, that the only things in that class are getters and setters for properties, or it's pretty close to almost everything as a getter and a setter, and maybe a couple methods or something like that. That's what a record is meant to be. And if you use the positional syntax, it becomes one line of code where you just, you know, public record, name of the record, open paren, and list the properties in order, close the paren, semicolon, and the compiler writes everything for you, right?
So slow that down now. Tell me about this positional. You don't have to write out property one get set, property two get set.
Exactly. If I were to create a person record, I would do public record person, open paren, string first name, comma, string last name, close paren, semicolon, okay?
That's beautiful.
Yeah, so I'm saving all those keystrokes. And now what the compiler does for me is it adds a get and set property, or a get and an init property for first name, a get and an init property for last name, an overloaded to string, a deconstruct method, and we can add inheritance to this because it is a class. So I've got to have an employee that derives from person, and it adds first name, last name, and, you know, title or whatever else you want to add. Now you're not limited by that. Instead of that semicolon, I could put open bracket, you know, whatever other methods I want, close curly bracket. Okay. So it's a way to kind of continue to grow these things over time and add more features to them if you find you need more behavior, you know, but it's kind of that what I want is this thing that really doesn't have a whole lot of behavior. It's just storing stuff for me, but I want it to be a reference type. So I'm going to make a record.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about making it a reference type.
Okay. So since C# 1.0, I could have made that person type to be a struct, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Right, which then everything gets passed by value. And that works in a lot of scenarios, but let's say it's in a place where maybe a person might not be the best example, but it's something that I don't want to allocate or I don't want these passed on the stack all the time because it contains a lot of other things. You know, it gets too big. I'd rather pass them by reference, but I still want it to act like that. So then I want a record. That gets to one of the things I haven't described so far in records, which is that records use value-based equality rather than referential equality. So if I were to say, you know, class person, the two objects of that type are equal if their object identities are the same. So it is like exactly the same, a single, you know, space in memory, a single object. But if I make it a record, now what I'm telling the compiler is I want these to be equal if all of their properties are the same. Okay?
Yes. So you could have two separate objects in memory, but as long as their properties are the same, they're equal.
Right. And that's where records come in. So now I can build these kinds of classes, these types, but I call them records because I want that value-based equality. And now the compiler does all the magic, like in my earlier example, where I had an employee record derived from a person record. An employee variable would not be equal to a person variable, even if the name properties were the same, because the compiler is going to check the types and go, oh, nope, this one is derived from the other. They can't be equal. They would have to both be employees or both be person objects.
Well, let me back you up just a bit. You were saying that in record, I could have two different records and have equality between them as long as their content is the same.
Right.
Why would I care? Why would I want to do that?
Because they're really holding data, not necessarily it's not meant to be the same object.
Got it. So hence the naming of it as record. And before I go on, you talked about, and you had a term for it where you put the properties in into the parentheses at construction time.
Right.
At design time, I should say. Does that also apply to classes now?
Nope, that is only available for records.
Okay.
Yep.
And can a record have a non-automatic property?
Absolutely. So, like I said, that positional record syntax, you know, there you're defining the properties that have to be set at construction time. You can add other properties, you can add other methods, you could add events if you wanted to, whatever else is up to you after that part. And you can also call something a record and not use that feature, you know, with the types or with the properties inside the parentheses. So I could go public, class, person, open curly, and write whatever properties, methods, anything that I want inside that.
Talk to me about the relationship between what we just said and immutability.
Okay, so when you create a record, what we've talked about is that the compiler writes a lot of methods for you. It writes things for quality, it writes things for, you know, positional records, for your get and init setters. It'll write a two-string method for you. It will write a deconstruct if it's a positional record, and so on. And any of those methods, none of those methods will change the state of a record. Okay, so unless you add something yourself, a record type is immutable. Okay? Now, as we just talked about, you can add any other methods or anything else that you want inside a record, and then they don't have to be immutable. The only thing that's guaranteed to be immutable is, we talked about that, the term was positional records, where I have those properties listed, you know, between parentheses right after declaring the record type.
I'm sorry, it's positional properties, right?
Right. Okay. So those properties are immutable. They will have a get accessor and an init accessor, and the init accessor can only be used at a constructor or in a property initializer. So if you try to set it outside of that, the compiler will issue an error.
Okay. So if I have a person and I use positional parameters that say string first name comma, string last name comma, and then I instantiate one of those records, I can set either in the constructor or in initialization, I can set the first name and last name, say to Jesse and Liberty.
Yep.
But later when I'm using that record, I can't just say my record dot first name is now equal to Bill. That would be illegal now.
Right. What you can do is use a syntax we call, we refer to as non-destructive mutation or withers. So let's say I named that variable Jesse. I could say person Bill equals Jesse and then the keyword with, and then inside curly braces, new initializer syntax, first name equal Bill. And that returns a new object that gets created that is almost like a copy of the old one. It's a copy of the old one, but with the properties specified have been changed.
Yes, got it. And what happens to the first record, the original record?
It's still there. It's still there in its original variable.
Okay. And does all of this is memory managed, so I don't have to worry about leaving that lying around.
Correct.
Okay, great. So now what I have is an immutable record. The properties, the positional properties are immutable. And I would use that immutability to what advantage?
Well, there's a few things that we like immutability for. One is immutable types are easier to test because once you've constructed them, they can't change. Another one is they can be shared across threads without danger because once they've been created, they can't change. So, you know, that non-destructive mutation we just talked about, it creates a new object. So you don't have this shared data issue where, you know, did I see something that was in the midst of changing? Nope, the original never changed. The other thread just has a new object. So they make some of those idioms a lot easier to work with. And that would be the primary advantage to working with an immutable type.
Now, let me just stop you for a moment. When you talk about threading, you're talking about creating, I guess, consciously creating a second thread as opposed to using async and await.
Yes, I'm talking about actual multi-threaded, you spawned up different threads that are working together to do different things or to do the same thing in multiple ways and trying to access some of the same data.
Great. And records are part of the C# 9 documentation.
Yes. I'm still working on a few bits of it, but we've got most of it in place.
Okay. Now, when I read through C# 9 documentation, records made a lot of sense to me. They were pretty easy to see where you use them and their constraints. Fine. Then I went to pattern matching and fell off a cliff. And I've seen your transportation example.
Yep.
And it's one of those situations like the international dateline. When you're explaining it to me, I absolutely get it. And then if I turn around and walk away, I don't get it at all. So I guess my first question is when you would actually use it. And the second question is, well, let's start with that. Let's start with the first question. When would you use that?
Okay. This is one that I think I'm still coming up with better ways to really explain it and have good ways to recognize it before I use it. And here, this is just like for me personally, since my day job is writing about C# features, when I get something new like that, I try to use it like almost everywhere just to see if it fits. And then I pull it out of places it doesn't fit. I'm a little bit past that with pattern matching, but I'm still not confident that every time I see something, I go, oh yeah, that's a pattern matching problem. Where I find it really, really useful is if I'm looking at the state of an object or some properties or characteristics of an object, and I'm going to make logical decisions on that. Like I want to branch if, then, else based on, you know, does the first name start with L or, you know, is the age over 16 so I can reach out to them on the, you know, and not violate GDPR by sending them an email, you know, these kinds of things. And using pattern matching, I can very quickly set up any kind of construct around one or more properties of an object and say, does it match those characteristics? And then I can have one method or something that says, when it matches those characteristics, do this. If it matches another set of characteristics, do this other thing. And, you know, that transportation demo, one of the ones where it showed walkthrough in that is there's this bit where it's calculating a toll for a bridge, maybe based on, you know, what kind of vehicle is it? What time of day is it? Are they going into the city or out of the city? And how many passengers are in the vehicle? So I've got like four or five variables I'm working with. And if you write that as if, then, else clauses, you end up with about like 45, 50 lines of code you have to reason about and check each case individually and go on.
Also, you end up, if you're not careful, you end up with if statements within if statements within if.
Oh, yeah. You almost can't avoid it. And if you use pattern matching, you say, I'm looking at these four characteristics of the vehicle that's going across the toll, and I'm just going to check against, you know, the truth table of all those four variables. It's a truck, it's a car, it's a bus, it's going into the city, it's going out of the city, it's morning, it's rush hour, it's middle of the night, it's afternoon, you know, whatever, right? So I've got those things set up. And then in each one of those, here's what your toll is. So it becomes something, you know, once you reduce some common cases, it becomes down to just 12 lines of code. And it's not just that it becomes denser. It becomes 12 lines of code that's really easy to look at. If those four variables match this, here's what happens. If they match this other thing, here's what happens. If they match, you know, if it's the weekend, no matter what it is, here's the answer. And it's very easy to look at and see. And now, as we keep enhancing the syntax or the kinds of things you can make for a pattern, it becomes really, really powerful to say, here's the data I'm looking at. What characteristics do I care about this data? And then what logic, you know, then where does my program go? Okay.
Yes.
And that is why I think it gets kind of tricky. It's a very mind-bending, different way to look at it than our traditional if, then, else, etc. For people that have a computer science degree, it's almost like looking at a finite state machine, right? Mm-hmm. I've got these variables and this is where it is. And therefore, this is what happens. And it doesn't matter how many variables they are, you know, how many characteristics I'm looking at, I just match against them. And this is what happens.
So it sounds to me like this is most useful. And it may be that I'm getting this from Mads, but it sounds to me like this is most useful for data that's coming in over the wire that you can't control the structure of.
You know, I think that is very, very true. You know, and if you think of it, you know, here's an analogy that sometimes is helpful. If you think of object-oriented program, we would define, you know, classes and virtual methods and a hierarchy of types in order to do something similar. I'm just going to call this method on this object. And because it's virtual, the type of object dispatches to a particular implementation of that method, right? And now with patterns, I'm not limited just to its type and just to doing this with virtual methods. I can say, here's the data, inspect it. And based on what you learn from those characteristics, then do something.
Yes.
You know, so it's a more free-flowing way to make that kind of, I want to dispatch to this code because of the characteristics of this object.
Okay. And pattern matching essentially came out in C# 8. Is that correct?
I think our very first features of it came out in 7.
In 7. Okay.
This is one of those interesting things as we get to that .NET cadence of every year is a new release.
Yes.
you know, to fully bake pattern matching, you know, there are going to be new pattern matching features and new patterns you can use in C# 10. But we introduced some in 7. We enhanced some of those in 8, added more patterns there. We've got even more patterns now that you can use in 9. And there's proposals for some in 10.
Well, let's talk about the difference between what was in 8 and is now in 9. What would be the significant, if I had been using pattern matching in 8 and 9 came along, what would that let me do that I couldn't do before?
Okay, the biggest ones that happened is we now have and, or, and not patterns. So I can say, like, you know, if first name equals Jesse and last name equals Liberty, whereas I'd have to like nest those or do something weird before, or I can do if first name equals Jesse or first name equals Bill. You know, those patterns work now. You know, we have not, you know, if last name is not equal to, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And we have relational patterns. So we can say, you know, again, my example, can I reach out to somebody without violating GDPR if age is greater than 16? So I can use greater than, less than, greater than equal, less than equal, instead of just equality tests.
Just, you know, tangentially, what is GDPR?
General data privacy regulations. It's the European standards for, you know, how we have to handle people's personal data.
Explanation of avoiding, of starting conceptually with nested ifs, which Sonar Cube will blow out of the water as cognitive complexity being too high, mm-hmm. and my own brain just fizzling, and me placing that with static, as you said, state machine, essentially state machine, is going to radically reduce how much you have to think about and how much you have to trace things with your fingers down into, you know, into nested if statements and so forth. Is that a fair thing to say?
I think that's its big advantage, you know, and that is how I've started to come to use it more. And what I even recommend is you're trying to play with it. If you see yourself writing more than one if and else, you know, if this and that, and then, you know, start nesting, see if you can make that a pattern. And when you make it a pattern, see if it's simpler. And, you know, I've been doing that, and I'll put it in 2 different commits so I can compare the 2 and go, which one makes more sense?
Okay. If I have 3 elements or 3 properties, mm-hmm. let's say what kind of vehicle it is, I'm going to use a distortion of what you did. What kind of vehicle it is, and what time of day it is, and which way you're going. Let's say those are the 3. Mm-hmm. And I want to pick a state like it's a car, and it's midday, and it's going in. How do I describe that to the compiler? Do I use a tuple, or what's the best way to do that?
That's usually what I've done in a pattern, is I will just make a tuple of the variables, you know, the characteristics that I care about on this particular pattern.
Okay. And there's now an underline which allows you to say any. Do I have that right? Any value for this particular characteristic?
Right. And that would just be an underscore, which is a discard.
Okay.
Yep.
And are those still... Okay. Let me switch you then to something that I think is related, which is switch expressions.
Right. And a switch expression is analogous to a switch statement, but the 2 things that are most useful about it is, because it is an expression, all of the arms have to return a value of some type. Okay. And now what that means then is you can chain those together. So I can switch on something and then take the output of that and switch on something else and so on, which, you know, can be really useful. Okay. And then for the switch expression, then your block, you know, in a switch statement, you would have case something and then however many statements you wanted underneath that. For a switch expression, there's only one expression on the right side of that lambda arrow. So here's my switch arm, the values I want to match, or the pattern I want to match against my inputs. And then I have an expression that must return a value. You know, it can be a method call if, you know, you need more extensive logic there, but it does have to be just an expression.
And what's the advantage of that constraint?
The expression part?
Yes.
Because then they can chain together. So they're composable. So I can go switch, some variable, yada, 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 dot, switch, and I can just chain them together.